Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bob Berman is joining us again, one of our favorite astronomers. He has a new book, and it is absolutely fascinating, The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. The sun has even cooperated for this interview. As I turn around from where I'm sitting in downtown Milwaukee, the sun is very bright today. It's shining. That's one of the questions that will be answered this hour. Why does the sun shine? Not the only question. You're going to learn so much. This conversation will carry you into being a fascinating person at any coffee shop gathering or with your friends for the year to come. Bob begins his narrative with the birth of the sun and ends it billions of years from now with the eventual death of the sun, the star's history, the impact on our daily lives, how we have viewed it through the years. It's only recently that we've learned a lot about the sun. He has been described as the world's most enthusiastic science teacher. I think that's correct. He writes about a number of interesting, fascinating aspects. The sun's transition to dominance in his own thinking, he said, took three decades. He says that that perhaps was because of youthful slow-wittedness. I'm not sure about that. But the turning point for him was a series of sun-related assignments. He was an eclipse leader at mind-bending totalities and then an Alaska Aurora Borealis lecturer for three winters. All of a sudden, he started altering his college courses, making the sun take up more and more of the curriculum for his students. And since the year 2000, all of these discoveries that used to be just trickling in have now become a flood. So there are all kinds of revelations about the sun. And he's our guest this hour of the program. Bob is an astronomy writer. He's author of the Night Watchman column. He's a contributing editor for Astronomy Magazine and host on the Northeast Public Radio Network and the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. He joins us by phone from the, I assume it's a lovely town. It has a great name, Willow, New York. Hello, Bob.
Hi, Kathleen. Great to be back.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you here. I just love this book. I loved it so much I was writing some of the things I learned on my Facebook page last night. Did you know that the sun, it was just filled with really interesting information? And it's amazing to me how much of this information is relatively new. We just didn't know much about the sun until fairly recently. It captured our imagination and our thoughts, but all this scientific information is new. Why?
Well, because suddenly we have a bunch of solar-dedicated spacecraft that are watching the sun nonstop with names like Source and Trace and ACE and SOHO and STEREO. And these are have just brought in so much more knowledge about the sun that we wouldn't have suspected. We certainly didn't suspect that there's a sun inside the sun. The sun is really made of two balls, actually three. We always knew that it had a core. That's where all the nice heat and light is generated, just in the innermost 10%. But then there's another region that extends out for about 70% of it, where the sun turns as if it were a solid ball, solid rubber ball. And then outside of that, the bets are off. All the chaotic rotation and the spin, where the poles take 30 days and more sometimes, and the equator spins in several days less, about a week less, and in between those boundaries, that's where all the juicy stuff is created. That's where its magnetic field is created, and we never knew this just 15 years ago.
Let's go way back, because we're fascinated by the stories that are emerging from places like Stonehenge. You talk about the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, which you say that we should all go to, and look at how central the sun was to daily life. Not only there, people who built the pyramids, but people who built Stonehenge, to cultures all over the world thousands of years ago.
Well, how could it not be? We have a single ball of fire that moves across the sky every day. And these days, in our busy modern world, few give it a thought, few give it a glance. But when you think about it, all of fire crosses the sky every
right.
day.
I know, ain't that something?
You know, who's picking up on that? And so, of course, in ancient times, they did. And there was no figuring it out. No one could even begin to scientifically even take the first step. How far is it? Why is it doing this? Is it burning? No, it's just a god. And they knew it gave life because certainly things got nice and warm and comfortable and the sun was out and cold when it wasn't out. And so everybody essentially just worshipped it back then, gave it various names. It was considered a god, and that was that. And that's how things stood for thousands of years.
But they had to look at it so carefully, didn't they, to know exactly when the solstice was and to build these huge stone entities that captured the light at a certain time. It was very careful observation.
It was. But it's a repeating pattern. And in the chaos of life, there's a lot of things around us, Kathleen, that don't repeat. You know, the buzzing of mosquitoes and the forming of clouds. Most of the things that happen just simply happen, and you can't get a hold of them intellectually. But here, we've got a pattern, and the human brain was designed to notice patterns. For example, if the phone rings just as we sit down to dinner, night after night, that's not going to escape our attention.
Right.
That's a pattern. And so the sun not only rises in the east, sets in the west, but in the course of a year, it rises at the exact same spot on the horizon and sets on the same spot on the horizon and repeats this at yearly intervals. So even though these observers of old were, yes, they were observant, they were perspicacious, but you almost couldn't help but notice this pattern, because a year fits in nicely with our lives, and building stones, putting up monuments to mark those positions, I could see that happening. There was no TV back then. What else were you going to do? That's the kind of thing that you'd want to do.
Right. You couldn't answer the phone at dinner time or not answer the phone at dinner time. Right. Let's talk about, you have some of these really interesting scientists too, but this is something that people will say, oh, really? When you talk about the greatest scientific breakthrough of all time that has furthered our knowledge of the sun, you say it is the spectroscope. Some of us may not even know what a spectroscope is. Why the greatest scientific breakthrough of all time?
Well, because the sun's light, or any kind of light, is actually a mixture. And all of us know that this sunlight is made up of different colors. We see them in a rainbow or in a piece of cut glass that's projected on a wall. And but what if the light of the sun could be separated and all the components seen side by side instead of just mushing together in our brains and in our eyes? And that's what a spectroscope does. It really just takes whatever is there in the light and puts it side by side. One reason why that's a great gift, too late for Christmas now, but if you were for the next holidays to buy a favorite science geeky person a handheld spectroscope and then look at street lights and fluorescent lights, and there's a pattern. And the pattern, it turns out, as it was discovered in the middle of the 1800s, corresponds to what creates the light. It's an amazing thing. In other words, if you take sodium, the element sodium, and you heat it up so that it glows, or you could even sprinkle some salt on a flame or in your stove, in your stovetop, and you'll see little pops of yellow. Well, you look at it in a spectroscope, and you see that there's two precise colors of yellow and nothing else that comes off when sodium glows, and no other colors. So now when we look toward the sun, the discovery, this is why it was such a great discovery, was that those exact same places where the yellow lines appear from sodium also appears on the sun. And so it was realized that, well, the sun has gaseous sodium on it. And so even though the 1800s began with astronomers believing that we will never know what the sun and the stars are made of, how can we? We can't go there. We can't take a sample to a laboratory. Suddenly, using a spectroscope, we could know exactly what the sun is made of and what gases are there.
What a discovery. Was that, what was his name, William Herschel? Was that his?
No, Herschel, who discovered Uranus, the planet Uranus, and also discovered, wonderfully enough, infrared rays, radiation.
Right.
So he was very cool. But it was Kirchhoff and Bunsen, Robert Bunsen, who we might remember.
Bunsen burner.
The Bunsen burner.
Right.
He's still most famous for that. Creating a laboratory gas burner that was just hotter than any other and very efficient. And we still remember it. But it was him and Kirchhoff, his buddy Kirchhoff. Two of them were pals, and they taught together in a college in Germany. And it was they who realized it. Actually, a kind of spectroscope had been invented earlier by the likes of Fraunhofer and others, but nobody really knew what these lines on the sun meant. It was these guys who figured out that it corresponded with actual elements and that we could figure out what things are made of by using a spectroscope. In fact, one night there was a fire in the other part of town, and they looked through their window and could see a house burning, and they got their spectroscope and looked at it, and sure enough, there were sudden appearances of spectral lines that showed elements like lead, and they realized that the plumbing in the house and some of the other elements were revealing themselves even from miles away. And and then they got the idea to turn it toward that brightest light in the sky, the sun. And what a discovery. Wow. And another big discovery was that the sun contains everything that Earth does. You'd think that the sun would be sort of magically composed of its own things, maybe elements that don't exist anywhere else. But there's nothing on the sun that isn't also on the Earth.
Nothing new on the sun.
I like that.
Nothing in the sun.
That's why you get paid the big bucks.
Yeah, right, the really big bucks. So how much do these spectroscopes cost? Oh, I want to go buy one now.
Good. If you go to eBay, you could get a good one for about $100.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe we could all chip in here at the office and get our own.
So cool.
What do you think, Rhonda? We'll get our own spectroscope.
It's so cool. And then with the spectroscope, you can look at even the way sunlight lights up other things. For example, you look at a lawn, and it looks green, or at least it did a few months ago here up in the mountains here. They're starting to fade a little bit with the cold. But why is grass green? Why are plants green? And we know that it's being hit by sunlight. We know sunlight has all the colors of the rainbow. But why should it look green? Well, with the spectroscope, it answers the question. You look at that, and you know what must get absorbed, what chlorophyll or what plants, what grass takes from the sunlight, what it likes to feed on, and what it reflects. And when you use the spectroscope, it shows you that grass is green because grass hates green. It hates the color green. I think we talked about this a little bit last time,
yes, right.
A month ago, and that it's kind of counterproductive. It isn't that chlorophyll or grass loves green. It hates green. So it lives on red light. It takes in blue light from the sun, but it reflects away green light. It doesn't like the sun's green light.
And talk more about this green light, because it's a very important thing that the sun is giving us, and we respond to it. We really take that in, and so signs are in green for a certain reason.
Oh yes, exactly. And it all starts because that's the sun's peak emission. That's what the sun gives off more strongly than anything else. And if you ask most people, well, what do you think the sun emits? They might think, well, maybe gamma rays, I don't know, ultraviolet,
right?
Because it burns us at the beach. Infrared, that's heat. The sun gives off more heat than anything else, doesn't it? No. What the sun puts off more than anything else is visible light, and in the visible spectrum, the peak emission is green.
Green.
And that's why our eyes, created to see by sunlight, designed to see by sunlight, most easily sees green more than any other color, so that when colors fade in twilight as it gets toward evening, and of course at night we're totally colorblind, we see no colors at all because our eyes switch to a different kind of film. I shouldn't use that word. Film was something that used to be used in photography, came on rolls and people would put it in cameras.
I remember, sure.
Right? So our eyes switch to a different kind of film at night that is colorblind. We don't see any colors at all, and it's also blurry. The best vision you ever have at night is 20/200 in low lights. When you're walking by moonlight or if the lights are dim in your house, the carpets look blurry, every detail on the wood on the floor that might have been clear by day is now all blurry because it's 20/200 at night. But by day, when we have this wonderful so-called photopic vision and we see all the colors, we are most sensitive to green. So even when our eyes start losing their color vision in deep twilight, we see green when all the other colors have disappeared.
Mm.
When the violets in a garden have faded to gray and the roses in a garden have faded to gray also, we can still dimly see green light, or greenish blue, actually, which is why the world looks greenish blue by moonlight.
Interesting.
You know, if you stop to think about it, it seems strange. We've got this white moon, and yet the white moon makes the world look greenish blue. And that's because our eyes only see the greenish blue light around us. We don't see any other color then. And so to exploit this, this is a long-winded way of answering your question. All the highway signs in the U.S. are all on the interstate highway system are all green. And many cities have switched to green fire trucks at night instead of the traditional red, because we can see green so much more easily.
Oh, that's fascinating. And it's one of the reasons why I love Ireland so much, because you can go on top of a hill and you can see so many shades of green. You never thought that that many existed on Earth. It must be one of the reasons that it's pleasing to us.
I've never been there, but I guess that's why it has its name. It's nickname, right?
Yeah, it is. Oh, you should go, Bob. You should go when they have some kind of eclipse. You'd have a good time.
Thanks. It's on my bucket list.
Okay. Bob Berman, our guest, his new book is The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. We have yet to talk about global warming. We have to talk about sunspots. We have to talk about how people figured out, imagine all the, you know, centuries ago, looking up at the sky and trying to figure out the sun and how far the planets were from the sun and how that discovery was made. There are some interesting events that take place just every now and then, and we'll talk about those that relate to the sun. And there are also substantial questions that Bob has about whether or not we'll be able to colonize other worlds and how problematic that may be because of the sun. So we have a lot more to talk about. We welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Bob is a very well-known astronomy writer. He wrote the popular Night Watchman column for Discover for 17 years. He's a columnist and contributing editor for Astronomy, and did the wonderful magazine, which we did an interview with him about this, on the weirdest things in the cosmos. We did that about, what, a month and a half ago. And he is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. So we'll be with you, with him, with the sun, the stars, and all this information in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for Bob. We start with Jack in Superior. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Question about how much does ultraviolet light heat up the Earth with the increase in Earth's temperature? Is ultraviolet light heating up the Earth even more?
No, it doesn't seem to be at all. Ultraviolet only corresponds to a percent of sunlight. It's a very small percent, even though it's very energetic. And even though it does vary more than any other part of sunlight with the 11-year sunspot cycle, it changes a lot more than the visible light does. If anything, we've had very quiet suns lately. We've had an unusual... In fact, the deepest sunspot minimum that any living observer has ever seen, in which the ultraviolet also became more absent than it's been in the life of anyone who's ever been looking at the sun now, between 2006 and 2009 particularly, and it's only now beginning to come back. So if it was going to do anything, it's protected us a little bit from global warming. It's mitigated global warming.
Hmm.
We have more cancer from sunlight, from ultraviolet. Why is so...
Ah, yes. Now, that's a different story because, it looks to be mostly because we're spending more time outdoors, because the population of at least the United States has been shifting toward the Sunbelt states. And the higher up the sun is, the more strongly the ultraviolet hits our skins and the more susceptible we are to skin cancer. But I hope we get a chance to talk later about that we should perhaps not be hiding out from the sun as much as we have been because of a fear of skin cancer, because sunlight may be better for us than bad for us.
Yeah, we may as well have that conversation now, because it is a fascinating part of the book, and I certainly took notice of it. I've suffered from several basal cell carcinoma incidents because I was a lifeguard when I was a kid, and I got some bad burns. You know, you used to really sit out in the sun all day long. But you made some very interesting points that the vitamin D is crucial.
That's right.
And we get it from the sun.
That's right. And you're quite right. Burning is always bad, and skin cancer is really related to number and severity of sunburns, especially bad sunburns, mm-hmm. especially for people with light complexions, red or blonde hair, blue eyes. You know who you are if you're susceptible to that, and it's never good to burn. But having been said, most skin cancers that are of any harm at all, of course, the melanomas, of which there are only 7,000 or 8,000 cases a year. Not to belittle it, but it's not one of the big cancers. And the cancers that scare people, oh, you have skin cancer. The truth is that almost all skin cancers are of that type that are that never metastasize, or that are just easily removed and cured. So even though it's very common, it's also pretty benign. Now balance that against what we've been doing, and the thing, John Canelli, physician on the Vitamin D Council, and many other researchers are downright scared that we've been hiding from the sun more and more. And we started, a process probably started 100 years ago when we went from a outdoor agrarian society to an indoor industrial society. Then it accelerated when we have windows that don't open. In office buildings now, they don't open, and glass totally blocks the sun's ultraviolet. So it's the ultraviolet that produces the vitamin D in us. Then in the last 30 years, mothers less and less let their kids run out after school because of either fear of sexual predators or because of the video game craze.
Right.
But kids come back from school and they're indoors.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a long time ago that kids would be allowed to just play outside with their friends and roam the neighborhood and be on bikes. Get some sunlight. So between all of it, there has been an amazing decrease in the amount of actual natural sunlight that people get. In other words, we've turned into a kind of race of mole people, underground people. And now you balance this out with the way our skin has been designed to produce vitamin D. Now, vitamin D is the most potent anti-cancer substance known. Vital to our well-being. And in natural sunlight, our skin, in bright sunlight, will naturally make the equivalent of 100 glasses of milk worth of vitamin D in 20 minutes.
Mm.
Now, why that degree of vitamin D production? Does nature do anything for no reason? You know, the implication here is that we were designed to be creatures outdoors that are supposed to get continuous and large amount of vitamin D production thanks to sunlight. We are not getting it. Laboratory tests show that almost everybody is vitamin D deficient. And some researchers on the Vitamin D Council and others fear that this is the real cause of autism.
Remarkable.
Increases and cancer increases. And, of course, it's a can of worms anytime you're going to say autism is caused by this or this. We all know that. But there's a lot of research going on, and some of it is pointing in that direction in Sweden and other places. And if I were a pregnant woman or a woman with a young child, I would not hide from the sun. I wouldn't automatically slather on sunscreen instead of going out. But I would make sure that myself and the developing fetus within, or your young child, gets abundant sunshine without burning. That's the key, without
mm-hmm.
burning. So you
mm-hmm.
can safely get 20 minutes, half an hour, even in the summertime. You know, unless you're very, very fair skinned. Everybody knows how much they can safely get.
Sure.
So the bottom line here is get as much sun as you can without burning.
Oh, you've said such a radical thing here, Mr. Berman. But it's good. I mean, it's interesting. And then it also, in reading the book, it made me realize how little we're in we think about the sun, because there are other layers to this. Then, when you write about ultraviolet light, you write about the vegetation that absorbs almost all of the UV, and it reflects none of it. So plants love this stuff; they take it in, and it doesn't bounce off on our skin as much. So if you do, and we all need to be a little bit careful about burning, you should be sitting on the grass because of what happens with the sun and the grass, rather than the sun and the sand.
Yes, exactly right. And for people who want to avoid burning, which we all should avoid burning, your environment plays a big role. For example, clouds will block ultraviolet, but only if they're thick. Thin clouds let almost all ultraviolet in. A hat won't really protect you if you don't have any sunscreen on when you're at the beach, because the ultraviolet comes at you sideways. It comes at you from the blue sky, and it bounces especially off sand. And as you just said, Kathleen, some environments bounce very little. For example, a lawn bounces almost no ultraviolet off it. So, in other words, a picnic on a lawn is always safer in terms of not getting a sunburn than a picnic on sand on a beach.
Oh, all these things. I love your book for this reason. All these things we've learned. It's just good. Jack, thanks so much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. We go to Chris in Oshkosh. Hi, Chris.
I just wanted to relate a story from my youth. When I was a kid, like around like one or two, or first or second grade, I had seen a show about the sun going supernova eventually and getting and expanding so much that it would burn the Earth to a crisp. And I thought that was pretty amazing. And so I went to school like later on, and I was telling the guys in the class about it, and they didn't believe me. They were like, they'd say, like, no, that's not going to happen. The military's going to stop it. And I was saying, like, that's not possible, I don't think. And I was like, no, they'll stop it. They will. I know they will. And I just wanted to relate that story, and I'll take any comments off the air.
Well, yes. In The Sun's Heartbeat, the last couple of chapters are about the future of the sun, or at least the last one chapter. The sun will never turn into a supernova, because only very massive stars do that. You've got to be at least a few times more massive or heavy than the sun to have that as your destiny. So the sun, fortunately, won't do that. But sometime like 5 billion years from now, it will expand into a red giant, and its surface may come awfully close to Earth at that point. Could even go a little bit beyond it, so that we'd be orbiting inside the sun. And at that time, I suspect you will need, like, sunscreen, probably SPF 1 trillion. Mm. And cars will come with air conditioning standard. It won't be optional anymore. Actually, long before that, the sun is going to destroy us in only 1 billion years from now, 1.1 billion years. It's kind of sad in a way, because life has apparently been on Earth for almost 4 billion years in one form or another. And we only have 1 billion left, because the sun is getting 10% hotter, brighter, every billion years. And so far, in the past few billion years, we've compensated for it. The Earth has, by changes in its atmosphere and more greenhouse gases and things like that. But we're out of compensation factors. Nobody can figure out any way that the planet can naturally block another 10% of the sun's luminosity and increase. So that in just 1.1 billion years, the temperature everywhere on Earth will be 700 degrees Fahrenheit.
Woo!
The oceans will have boiled off. That's the end of the story.
Wow. You also put a damper on being able to inhabit other planets because of the sun. We just wouldn't be able to take in the rays. They would destroy our brains.
Oh, yeah, that's for the sun's emission. They're essentially, the radiation that comes from the sun. Radiation takes a number of different forms, but here we're talking about the little particles that come from the sun, broken bits of atoms that the sun is always throwing off into space. It was first postulated only in the 1950s by Gene Parker and called the solar wind. And now we found that the solar wind is always there. Sometimes it sends out explosions that are more powerful, especially coronal mass ejections, and those are like shotgun blasts of particularly virulent swarms, dense swarms of high-speed broken atoms, and these are not good for you as they penetrate your body. In fact, the astronauts on their way to the moon, once they got outside of Earth's protective magnetosphere, our magnetic field, blocks these, fortunately. But as soon as they were going to the moon, every astronaut reported seeing it looked like a meteor going across his field of view once a minute, like a flash of light.
And nobody
back at Mission Control told the astronauts what it was because they didn't want to worry them. But it turned out like these were large particles, atomic particles, ripping through their brains.
Oh, my gosh. Seriously?
Yeah. Now, once you get to the moon, which has no magnetic protection, and Mars, which also has no magnetosphere, there's nothing to stop this incoming radiation. And so it's calculated. In fact, that's what the new Mars mission is measuring. It's on its way to Mars
right now,
and next summer when it arrives, we'll measure precisely what the surface radiation flux is. But everyone expects it to be pretty intense. That's why Shannon Lucid, the most experienced woman astronaut in the United States at least, despairs of us ever colonizing or even spending long periods of time on any other planet because of this radiation.
We just can't do it.
Huh. Yeah, it's been calculated that in a mere two-year Mars mission, an astronaut would lose somewhere between 15 and 40% of their brain.
Well, you can't have that happen.
Even us smart people can't afford that.
Exactly. Yeah. Chris, thanks for your call. Tony is next in Montello. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Hi.
Just a quick question for those of us that don't always get outside enough. How does full spectrum lighting benefit at all with the vitamin D issue or any other issues?
Well, if it's the type of lamp that produces vitamin D, in other words, those tanning lamps which has ultraviolet, in other words, helps us produce vitamin D, that would work. But it's a little, you have to be careful with that because, again, you don't want to burn your skin. And some physicians think that taking vitamin D supplements are the answer. And, of course, in the wintertime when the sun is low and there's no way you're going to get enough vitamin D no matter what you do, it's probably good. The people on the Vitamin D Council say you should take at least 4,000 international units a day, at least. There's no toxicity up to 30,000 units, so there's no harm in doing that. But there's nothing like the natural thing. So especially during the time of year that you can go out, wear as little clothing as you can, wear shorts, short-sleeve shirts, and get 15 or 20 minutes on each side of your body.
Thanks, Tony, for your call. We haven't spent much time talking about sunspots, so let's do that right now. You write that researchers are quite sure that the sunspot cycle, and I'm wondering if you would describe what the cycle is, does indeed correlate with the temperature of the Earth, with the amount of solar energy it receives, with the appearance and frequency of auroras, the position and strength of the Gulf Stream, the thickness of the atmosphere, the health and longevity of Earth satellites, the clarity of radio transmissions, and the list goes on.
That's right. And it's a tricky business because ever since this periodicity was first noticed by the likes of Schwab back, we're talking about 150 years ago, and we realized that the sunspots come in an 11-year cycle where they get more of them and then less of them, more of them. At the times that there are more sunspots, there's also more solar storms. The sun gets a little brighter. The ultraviolet, especially the far ultraviolet, increases tremendously. And people have noticed auroras greatly increase in frequency. The opposite happened. A strange thing happened between 1645 and 1715. The sunspot cycle just stopped in its tracks. There were virtually no sunspots for that whole human lifetime. And during that time, Earth got much colder. The Thames froze, which nobody had ever seen. The canals of Venice froze.
Mm.
There was a lot of hardship around the world. We had in the colonies, we had the worst winters ever at that time. And so there really appears to be a, not just appears, there is a connection between the sun's heartbeat, which is its 11-year cycle. It's actually a 22-year cycle if you include the magnetic polarity of the spots. But here you have to be careful because we humans love cycles. We love to match things with other things and This really brings everybody out of the woodwork looking for, okay, so let's see, every 11 years this happens, so, and then you can compare it with thousands of earthly things. You can compare it to women's fashion and wars and economic upturns and downturns. And since there have only been 24 cycles that have been carefully monitored, and there are thousands of potential things to compare them to, of course you find a lot of stuff that seems to match. For example, the length of skirts in women's fashion, the party that controls Congress, the number of rabbits in Australia, all seem to march up and down with the sunspot cycle. However, most of these things are just coincidence. So separating what's really real and connected with the coincidences, that's the real job. And so we're pretty sure that the real stuff are the things that you just mentioned.
And the cycles are predictable or they're not predictable?
They're semi-predictable. It is roughly 11 years. This one really threw us for a loop because after the last cycle ended and you have a sunspot minimum, it lasted so long from 2006 to 2009, and the new cycle, number 24, was so delayed in beginning. Originally, we thought we were going to have the next sunspot maximum happening in 2011, last year, and they pushed it to 2012. Now it's 2013.
Huh.
And so they vary. Although it's 11 years, it can range as much as almost 17 years.
But it always, the Earth is always cooler during high activity?
The sun is, we're warmer during high activity, which means more sunspots. It's kind of a paradox that the more dark spots are on the sun, the warmer Earth gets.
I see.
Because that corresponds to storms on the sun, and the brightness is around the sunspots.
And you may want to tell us what people used to think. It's amazing what we thought not very long ago was going on with the sun. First, that people lived there. And what did they think these spots were?
Well, okay, for a long time, and I mean 250 years, if you were a schoolboy and you looked at a astronomy textbook, you had to study this stuff in school, what you were taught from the 1700s to about the year 1900, so about 200 years, you were taught that the sun is covered with a glowing liquid, and that those spots on the sun were mountains sticking up from the molten glowing liquid on the sun. But there was a sizable minority of astronomers, and this also appeared in the textbooks. I collect all the antique astronomy books and textbooks, so I love reading this stuff, and it's right there. They thought that the sun just has two layers of clouds, an outermost region that has glowing clouds, and that's the brightness that we see. And then underneath it, a protective region, sort of like hazmat shields, a shielding of clouds that keeps the sun's surface. That's what they thought, that the sun had a solid surface, nice and pleasant. And that William Herschel, again, the discoverer of Uranus, actually advocated they were human-like creatures living on the sun and the tranquil meadows and pleasant places on the sun underneath the clouds that protected them from the outermost clouds. And they thought the outermost clouds would sometimes part, and then you could see the dark surface underneath. And that's what the sunspots were.
Mm. And how did people, and who figured out, it's interesting to put yourself, or try to put yourself back in the mind of somebody who lived centuries ago looking at the sky, because it's still dumbfounding to go look at the sky and to look at the sun. But who was it who made the breakthrough of figuring out how far away the sun was and then figuring out how far we were from Venus and from some of the other planets? And how would you go about determining that when you didn't have a spacecraft?
Right. The easiest way was parallax. It had been noticed that one observer in one part of the world, let's say even one part of Europe, would see the moon right in front of certain distant stars, and at that same moment, another observer hundreds of miles away would see the moon in a slightly different spot. So they were looking at the moon from different angles, and so using trigonometry, you could calculate how far away the moon was pretty accurately, and this was done in the early 1700s. But when it was tried with the sun, it was hard to get an accurate result. both because the sun is 400 times farther than the moon and because it's so bright and hard to see. And so even back then, hundreds of years ago, the sun was thought to be somewhere between about 60 million and 100 million years ago. And refining that, that became the holy grail of finding out exactly how far the sun was. And doing that, there were so many wrong ideas and crazy ideas back then that you had to battle them too, including one man who wrote that the sun was actually made of ice. Made of ice. Because in the Bible, and remember, they were even scientists were trying to make everything compatible with the Bible back then. It mm-hmm. wasn't easy, because supposedly the sun was created after there was already light. If you look at Genesis, there was light on the earth, but the sun was created several days later.
Mm-hmm.
So that means, according to them, that the sun could not have been the source of our light. So they thought that the sun must be a giant lens that really focuses the light from the rest of the universe here. And what could this lens be made of? Not glass. That would be too artificial and man-made. It must be ice. Now, one proof of that is that if it was really, if the sun were really fire, when you go closer to a fire, it feels warmer, right? But when it comes to the sun, if you climb a mountain, the sun, it gets cooler and cooler and mm-hmm. cooler. Everything feels cooler when you go up the mountain, when you get closer to the sun. So using this reasoning, they thought the sun could not be made of fire, it could not be the source of heat, but must just be a ice crystal that's focusing the light here. So there are all sorts of wacky ideas that had their own kind of logic to them. Another idea was that the Earth was a sunspot, and that the sun actually puts off little particles that it sends into space, little heat particles, but as they leave the sun, some of them glom together and form clumps, and eventually these clumps cool to become planets. And so by that reasoning, we live on a sunspot.
Do we have any crazy ideas now, Bob?
I think a lot of them, Kathleen.
Do we?
Will prove to be crazy in the fullness of time. We're so in our infancy when it comes to understanding cosmology.
Mm.
The Big Bang and dark matter and dark energy, these are all mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the ideas that we have will seem crazy, I think, in just 20 or 30 years.
Well, we've only got a billion years to figure it out, so we better get moving, right? Yeah, Bob Berman is our guest. His book is The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Anita in Windenhurst. Hi, Anita.
Hi. We talk about the absorption of vitamin D all the time at work, and this is what we think, but we need to get the facts from you, that you normally don't absorb vitamin D through your skin, but rather through your eyes, and now that there's a thought that can absorb it through the backs of your knees. So we just need to know where we should put the sunblock.
Well, again, don't use sunblock if you believe what these vitamin D researchers are saying. Use it sparingly. First, let yourself get lots of sunlight. Don't burn. And only when you get to the point where you think if you're going to get more, you might burn, then use the sunblock. And it's the whole skin. The skin creates it. And so it's no one part of the skin. It's definitely not the eye. It's all of the skin that creates vitamin D. So you don't put any of that stuff just in your eye.
All right, Anita?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Email from Andrew. Could you talk about photosynthesis and quantum properties of light? I read an article recently finding evidence of quantum property of superposition in plants photosynthesizing light into energy. The researchers observed light absorbed by the plant taking the path of least resistance through the possible energy pathways through the plant's cells. Very interesting study concerning the natural way in which the sun, light, and quantum properties manifest themselves in nature. And you may have to fill us in a little more on what quantum properties means.
Well, just quickly, it means that in the land of the small, objects don't behave the way they do here in our macroscopic everyday life.
Mm.
And photons, light could be thought of as either waves or photons, tiny particles, definitely behave in quantum ways. And all of the experiments either done with a double slit, where where you send either electrons or photons through, or entangled particles, which is a wonderful quantum phenomenon where one bit of light or one electron knows what its twin is doing, even if they're separated by the width of the universe, knows what it's doing and will mimic it in an exact way, in a complementary way. So light does behave in a quantum way. I have not seen this article on plant behavior when it comes to absorbing light in a quantum way, so I'd have to read that before commenting on it.
Chris in Wisconsin. Hi, Chris.
Hi. When I'm watching a sunset, once in a while, am I able to see a sequence of colors that would be the same sequence as if I was walking past a prism?
Yes, and that's because the sun that we see is actually a series of slightly offset colored images, so that when the sun sets, what happens is that the red image of the sun sets first, followed by the orange and the yellow, and the final sun that would set would be the blue sun, except there's so much air between us and the sunset that the blue has really been scattered away. There is no blue, so the topmost sun image is green. And if conditions are just right, if the air is very homogeneous or steady in temperature, especially out over the ocean or a large lake, you might see the topmost tiny orange bit of the sun or red bit of the sun turn to green, a vivid green.
Ooh,
just for
really?
A second or two, commonly called the green flash, and it's real. I've seen it about 15 times. I've looked for it at every sunset, maybe 300 sunsets, and I've seen it 15 times, if my own experience is any guide.
Mm. Oh, I'm sure your experience is a big guide. Thank you, Chris. We go to Brian in Milwaukee. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, this is Brian from Milwaukee. Bob, I had a question for you. I'm very heavily involved in yoga in Milwaukee, and I grew up in India, and I've come across a couple of yogis in India who are absorbing energy straight off the sun, as the sun being the primary source of energy on Earth. And some of these guys have not eaten food for almost a month. All they live off is water and sunlight. Do you have any insights on this? Some of these guys have been tested in U.S. scientific labs here in America, and for 10 days they went without food and without water. All they needed was to absorb sunlight. Are you aware of any?
No, I'm not aware of it. I know that Surya, the sun, the name of the sun in India, is very revered and worshipped, and it's a name even in the Indian culture, is it not, Surya?
Right.
And and I have spent quite a bit of time in India, and I love that culture, but I don't know about how long you could go without any food, just getting sunlight. I know sunlight's good for you, water is good for you. Would it really serve to give you all the nutrients? Generates vitamin D under the surface, but would it give you everything that you need? Could you really live just on sunlight? Sorry, but my scientific side would be skeptical about that, and I wouldn't recommend that to anyone. And I guess for the amount of time that they did that, there's no harm. But we're not just talking lawyers here to say don't try this at home.
Right. Send us more information about it, Brian, if you would, and we'll get that information somehow to Bob as well. Thank you very much for the call. Do you have sunshine today?
Oh, here in the mountains, yes, it's peeking in and out. And, of course, this time, just a little bit past the solstice, when the sun is so low in the sky, any bit of sunshine is always almost worshipped the way it was in the olden times.
Yeah, and you must have a special relationship with the sun every day. You and I will too now after talking to you and reading this book. I haven't thought about it very much. I mean, you do, but we need to really think about it.
Yes, on so many different levels, and not to mention the things that it can give us, like the aurora. And I know where you are in Wisconsin, you get fabulous auroras.
Uh-huh.
I think this year, 2012, and next year, you should be able to see, as soon as you get away from the lights of any big cities, probably 4 or 5 great auroral displays.
Ooh, let us...
Now that the sun is heating up, and the other great naked eye thing it does is a total eclipse. We're going to be having one not too far from you in the year 2017.
All right, we'll talk again. Happy New Year, Bob. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you. Bob Berman, our guest. The book is The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the star that powers our planet. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios where the sun is shining.